I'm pleased to introduce Vern Swanson, who I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing. Vern is a retired director of the Springville Museum of Fine Art. He started out playing football for BYU, then for a year coached semi-professional football himself. After that, he went into a whole career involving art. We're here tonight to hear about his story and what happened to him after he lost his wife and child.
Thanks for coming.
Hello, everyone. I'm thrilled to be here. I happened to be here just last June the 20th, 2002. And so I spoke to your group. I guess they wanted me to back. It's been 15 years. I'd like to come back in another 15 years if I'm alive. I doubt it. But anyway, I have to tell you, I don't think I had a near-death experience. I had a death experience. Maybe that's a little different. I got a little close to it. Maybe that's near, but my wife and child actually did die. We'll be talking about them appearing to me in May of 1975. And so it's been a long time ago. I haven't really spoken since the last time I spoke to you all. I don't think I've ever really spoken about it, and maybe a little bit to really close friends when the question might come up. There was a book by Arvin Gibbons.
Gibson.
He wrote it up in one of his books. And so it is there. I hope I say it right, like I did before. But anyway, there is one thing I do know, is that those who have deceased, who are dead, do not consider themselves dead, and they get very angry if you call them dead people. They don't like it. They're actually very much alive, I can tell you. We'll get into that. As the scripture goes, dead in the flesh, but alive in the spirit. I was teaching at Auburn University in Alabama. Anybody know the War Eagles? A war eagle, right? Well, anyway, the Auburn Tigers, the Auburn Plainsmen, I was a professor there. I was in my office with some students, four or five students. Knock on my door. It was my two home teachers. What did they do in my office? You know, they hardly came in the month, right? Much less, you know, my first thing I said, but this isn't the end of the month yet. Anyway, I looked at their faces. Didn't have to say a word. I just looked at their faces and went, what happened? I mean, I knew what happened. I don't know why. You just, no. Well, anyway, they said, we need to get you to the airport. I was the house daddy of the Sigma Chi fraternity. And my wife was the mother sweetheart of Sigma Chi. She wasn't the sweetheart of Sigma Chi, but she was kind of adopted by the boys. So we were the house family, my wife and son and I. And it was great. We really enjoyed it. Well, anyway, so we went to the fraternity and got closed around, and off we drove to Atlanta to the airport. We flew to Great Falls, Montana. What had happened was, my wife's brother was getting married in Cardston, Alberta, and they decided to drive. That's a long way from Cardston, Alberta to Auburn, Alabama. But they did it anyway, and so she drove there with some other people who needed to go. So the marriage took place, and they were coming back. So there was my wife, my son, and my sister-in-law, my wife's sister, Robin, in the car driving south. They left in the afternoon. We're going to drive all night to go to Salt Lake, and then from there, the rest of the trip. Well, they got to Choteau, Montana. It's a small road, just a windy two-lane highway, and there was a blizzard. That day, it was the 29th of April. Not totally late, but kind of late for a snowstorm. And the wind was blowing, and, you know, it gets pretty cold there in Montana. But it was late in the evening, maybe in the a.m., and the car went over the midline. The other car approaching came over, and as it were, they collided. The other lady was instantly killed, as was my wife. My son lived a little bit longer. He was being held by Robin, my sister-in-law, and he actually saved her life. So she did make it through the accident. So they were taken to Great Falls, Montana, to the hospital. The bodies were taken to Calgary, Alberta, Canada, where my mother and father-in-law lived. They set up the arrangements for the funeral. Now, when this happened, when I heard it, I was just like, okay, where do I need to be? It was just like a daze, you know? And I felt really bad, but I was more just dazed than almost disbelief, but I knew it was true. But they organized the funeral because of the wreck. It was pretty devastating. They saw the bodies, but they said, Vern, don't look at the bodies. So we went from there up to Calgary for the funeral, and they said, we wish we hadn't. I don't recommend you do. And so I'm listening, and they said, well, we made the decision to put them into the same casket. So both bodies into the same casket. And I said, that's fine. That's great. You know, it's a good funeral. And then I flew back to Auburn, Alabama after a couple days. Every one of you have experienced deaths in your family. Every single one of you have had your Gethsemanes. Right? Haven't you, everyone? Has anybody not had a Gethsemane? You know, where you went there and just right to the closest precipice of falling off into the abyss, you know? Anything that I have suffered, every one of you have suffered to a degree worse or maybe not so bad, but we're not all strangers to it. The Wilcott poem that goes, Wheeler Wilcott, all of us, sooner or late, must pass within the garden gate. It's true. Okay, now, so I was older. I was a professor, and so I knew that things like this would happen, can happen, have happened. So I was running on adrenaline. That's what you really run on at that time, to just get through, and you kind of seem a bit normal, you know, and you are kind of normal because kind of pull yourself together and you're upright and straightened. Well, once I got back to Auburn, I got back into the, I wanted to just get back into it, right? As opposed to going off to a deserted island or something. Thought that would be best. But I began to sag. And I sagged a lot. But before I go into the rest of the story, let me introduce you to my wife, okay? This is my wife and I. I look younger there. You can hardly believe that's me. I said to my wife the other day, I'm just not the man I used to be. And she looked at me and she said, and you never were. How did I feel? But anyway, so that's Elaine to the left and I'm to the right. And this is just 3 days after we met. And you see the quote above it? I was swimming at this swimming pool and I saw Elaine. I went, oh my goodness, wonderful. So I swim over to her, and I asked her if she'd like to have her palm read. I don't know how to read palms, but I know how to make up stories. So anyway, I took her hand, and holding it like this, and I said, thank you. And she said, well, what did it say? I said, oh, I never read aloud. Well, anyway, but I took her hand, and I said, if I had a hand like this 5 years ago, I'd have a full house now. The card game, you know, poker. She got it. She started to laugh. I've actually used that line a lot. Nobody ever laughed, you know. And so I knew that she was pretty good. This is great. Well, anyway, so we were married, and then we had a child. This is my wife, Elaine, and this is the last photograph that I have. Maybe somebody has some others. But anyway, so here we are in the backyard of the Sigma Chi fraternity at Auburn, sitting on a log, and Brett, my son, and he's 2 and a half, Elaine, and myself, again, not looking like I do now. Now we'll go to that point that I'm back. I'm getting into the rhythm of things, but I'm not me. Because I looked and I only saw one casket there. Where's my son? I mean, I know that's Elaine in there. They told me Brett's in there, but is Brett in there? Where is he? In fact, where's she? I understood about Elaine because she had grown up, got married, had a child. I mean, she didn't grow old, but she got to do the basic things that people do, right? But Brett didn't do anything. He was just 2.5 years old. And so it began to work on me, and I began to go into a depression. I could just feel like this darkness or maybe a wall coming in. It was very suffocating. I remember a lady offering me a puppy. She brought the puppy and gave it to me and said, I know that you love this puppy and to keep you company. I couldn't just, it's just too soon or whatever. But I saw myself going down, grieving almost continuously. I became morose, very depressed, and I suffered severely, didn't sleep or eat well. I could have knew I was sinking into an unhealthy abyss, but I didn't seem to be able to control it. At the end of the summer, I was really going downhill. Well, actually, by midsummer, I think. I was really going downhill. In the fraternity house, our room, we had very small quarters, but there's a room, like a sitting room, and a our bedroom, and some closets. And then the main wall divided the cafeteria from our quarters. So we always heard the boys get up, and they're always noisy. But, you know, that's the way it is, and we got used to it. But that wall wasn't all that thick that they couldn't probably hear what we're saying, but they could hear that we're talking. Well, anyway, so I'm sleeping, and it's just a normal night. I'm just sleeping there, and all of a sudden, I heard burn. I woke up, and there was Elaine standing there at the end of the bed. I popped right up. I mean, I just flung up. It's very strange. I haven't been able to understand this. I've asked a few people in the know about it, but so I jump out of bed. I'm here, but they're not standing here. The end of the bed, and she's not facing me like here's the end of the bed, and there I am. She's not like this. She's like this. Does anybody know what that means? I have no idea. I thought that was unusual. I mean, not at the time, but just in reflection. So I just jump up, and she is absolutely gorgeous. Looking better, just like an inner glow. It was just beautiful. And I grab a hold of her. She's solid. And I just start kissing her. And she's not going, oh, she's not doing that. She's kind of like business, very businesslike, very officious. I guess I was more depressed about my son than my wife, because that seemed to be the anchor pulling me down, because not understanding where he would be and the situation. And so she said, Vern, he's dead. Then I looked down, and then I noticed for the first time that she's actually holding Brett in her hands like this. I started kissing him, and as warm and radiant as Elaine was, Brett was colder and like clay. And I said, no, 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 no. She said, Vern, he's dead. And then I said, no. And then she repeated it the third time, Vern, he's dead. And I'm just in absolute tears. I had a question I wanted to ask. Where are you? How does this work? I need to know. If somebody is lost, you ask them where they're from, or somebody's phoning you, you say, where are you at now? I didn't. And she didn't answer. She only said those three things. She didn't say anything else to me. The next thing I remember, I'm in bed and upright with my feet on the bed, and I'm sitting upright, bawling so loud, just in absolute tears. And I look at the clock at morning time. The brothers would have been down for breakfast, but I don't hear them because they hear me. They know I'm having a problem in my room. Okay. I get ready, and I walk out. Hi, how are you? Yeah, good, you know. Yeah. And the brothers knew that something has happened because, I mean, obviously they loved my wife. So the upshot, what happened was that from that moment, as depressed as I was, and I'm not normally given to depression. I'm just not. Some people here know me best, know that I can get mad, but I don't stay mad. I never stay mad. I can be depressed for 2 minutes, and that's about as long as I can go before I smile and be happy. But anyway, but I came up out of that depression like you're down low and deep into the water, and you just pop up like a buoy. And I've never worried about their condition, where they are, what they're doing, everything's fine. And she didn't say they're fine. I just knew they're all fine. You just know. Now, I know that this happens to, and you know so much better than I, because I'm not a student of near-death experiences. Martin tells me a variety of near-death experiences. I just know that in a lot of these cases, that other people are able to re-energize their lives and move on and keep going and have maybe a better life afterwards than they had even before. Strange thing happened. I have a little breakfast group with Al Switzer, who wrote the book Crucial Conversations, New York Times bestseller, and Gerald Jacobs. Is Gerald here today? Okay. And Kimball Warren, the artist, the painter. Okay. That'd be another painter right here. Well, and then Pilar Pobel's back there. And is there any other painters and artists here? Oh, there's a couple. Oh, good. What's your name?
Yeah.
Thank you. Now, so I told him I was coming here, and he said, something like that happened to me. His 11-year-old daughter, who went into, is it insulin shock? She has to have insulin, or she'll die. Okay. He fumbled with it and dropped it and broke the needle, and she died in his arms, 11-year-old girl. Oh, my goodness. He suffered so badly. And then she appeared to him and said that she's just fine. She said, you go back to work. You know? So this does happen. It was almost like my story, too. He was faltering, going down, and she came, and he said, I never worried thereafter. And I've been able to, whenever I think, it's all just very pleasant and wonderful. I just think of every good time, and it's okay. I am LDS. The rest of this talk is a little bit directed toward the question that everybody has. An atheist goes through some veil or some near-death experience, and they say, I come back and I believe in God. Others may come back and say they don't. A Buddhist might experience something that a Buddhist would experience. Catholic or a Protestant or a Hindu or Muslim, they have near-death experiences as well, and they would experience the same thing. My experience would be colored by my belief system. So I'll just tell you what came of it. This is amazing. See the maze there? Me trying to be funny, but and baffling world. I believed in a premortal life, and then the earth life, and then we go to the heavens. It was just all that in between. That actually is a working maze. I mean, it does work out. I followed it through. It took me a while, but it is a maze. Other people had other solutions. Since that time, I've had the opportunity to write 5 books on Soviet socialist realist art. So 50 trips to Russia, many of them with Jim DeBacchus. I think some of you might know Jim DeBacchus. And I know Martin has worked with Jim and with the Russian art. Here's a Marxist-Leninist plan of perfectionism of mankind. You know, there are other plans. Here's one. Not exactly my plan. So I was lost. And I tried to figure it out. And so, lost, used GPS. God's plan of salvation. So, I wanted to know, but I didn't want to know just generally. I wanted to know specifically. I didn't want a general knowledge, but while I might have a workable knowledge, I wanted to have a scholarly knowledge. Like 30 seconds after they die, they arrive at, and there they're greeted by, and then they're escorted to, and they move from here to there to there to there. I would have liked it had a perfect diagram. How does it all work? How does it fit together? Well, I didn't have that before my wife's death. I would say during the funeral, I was sketching out some little plans. This X here, and the line goes over here to this circle. Now, I have seen this one. This is 1950. This is the oldest drawing that I have ever been able to find on LDS plan salvation. Okay, kind of fun. How many of us have done this in order to understand the plan? How we fit and where we go from here? Where'd you come from? So, you see, has anybody ever just noodled out things? People noodle these things out. And everybody wants to make them as simple as possible. So when I got back from the funeral, remember, I was teaching art and art history. And so I went into the painting class, my student class, and I had a 2x6 piece of masonite. I sized it, I was drawing on it, and I started to paint a plan of salvation, kind of a diagrammic, and so I didn't have people in it. I'm sure artistically it was wanting, but I started to paint that. That's the last thing I would have done 3 weeks before. But now, I was interested in that. I'm trying to figure this thing out after my wife had appeared to me and my son. What did it give me? It gave me hope and courage and took away my worries and fears. But it also instilled something. I need to do something on the plan of salvation. Because I had seen 2 plans, not very good ones. Sometimes people make them simple. You see this one here? They have GPSs on cars nowadays. GPS, the God's plan of salvation. So there's a circle, then a line, then a circle with a dot. And that dot is, you are here. That's a you are here dot, okay? And then a line, which is death, and then a spirit world, which either go to paradise or spirit prison. Okay, but have you ever noticed it? I don't understand this. It's like here's the planet, and they divide it at the equator, and everybody south of the equator are going to spirit prison. Like the penal colony in Australia? Yeah. And up north is where all, well, anyways, it's not exactly going to be that way, but you get the idea. Then there's death and the judgment, and then you go to where you belong. I made another one. You want to see it? Now, this is my serious one. Oh, well, I didn't really make this one, but I found it. You can have a lot of fun. And whoever made this, and can anybody read what that says down below? At the very, very bottom where it says by, and it names the author. Can you read that? I can't. But if you can, let me know, because I'd like to give them a footnote. Anyway, so now, Calvin and Hobbes obviously are just a way of making the plan fun and exciting. Well, so I painted the picture. But I painted it before class, and then I put it away, and then I work with students. And then after class, I'd bring it out, and I'd work on it. And I had a little thing there for the paintings that I was working on, as every student had a little bin for the paintings they were working on. Some of the students pulled it out and looked at it. What is this? And what are you working on? And I tell them, they said, oh, it's all about, because of the pre-mortality, oh, it's all about reincarnation. Or people would say MMP, multiple mortal probation. No, it's not. It's not that. I get on, and they say, oh, some of them liked it, some of them hated the idea. But anyway, a lot of people are making them as simple as they can. About 3 months later, somebody stole my painting. But they just didn't take mine. They went in and maybe took a half the class. Must have been 25 paintings they took. Just pulled up with the car and took them away. One student, I remember I had to console them because nobody stole their painting. They felt left out. They felt, what, mine isn't good enough to steal? No, no, don't break your brushes just yet. When I was at BYU, I really wasn't a very good artist, frankly. But I was quite a good art historian. I got my master's at the University of Utah, and then my PhD at Courtauld Institute of Art, University of London. In fact, they tore up my artistic license with my undergraduate program. Have you ever had that happen to you? Boy, that's tough. But because somebody stole my painting, I couldn't start another one. And then so instead of doing it visually, I began to do it and writing it out. So I took nearly 45 years now, I guess, or so, to do the book. And the book is nearing completion. You know, 45. I hope I get it done before I die. I'm writing a book on the last days, and I'm just hoping I get it done. It's all a history book rather than a future book. Well, anyway, yeah, I always come back and finish it. I worked on the problem year after year after year, the details, and the old microscope just kept burrowing down, digging deeper into it, all because of this experience I had way back. I mean, so I wanted to do a PhD level one. And so here is my plan of salvation. My publisher, Lyle Mortimer of Cedar Fort, who will actually be publishing this, he took a look at it. He said, I'm a little bit put off. It looks like so much is happening. I don't understand it. Well, I had written on the back, and here it is, the Father and Son's plan of joy and happiness. You just open it, like in a Catholic cathedral, you open up the altarpiece with its two wings, and there it is. And then on the back is written the details of things you might not know, but maybe hadn't thought of, but you hopefully go. William Blake once said, the truth, if explained understandably, is always believed. I would change that is often believed. When somebody says it's foolproof, they haven't taken into account a clever enough fool. Okay. So here is the plan of salvation according to my son-in-law, who knows how to do graphics. We got it done about a month ago. The book will be coming out here in another year or two, but this is the first of the plan. We thought we'd revisit the visual plan, and it will be informed by the research of the book. And then it turned out that by doing it visually, it informed the book. So the book, that's kind of nice because you want to look at the different angles. That's why we have two eyes instead of one, polyhemus. It'd be nice to have one big one in the middle or one in the back. You see the pyramid in the top middle? To the right side of that pyramid is a bunch of dots, and those are called particles of intelligence. And this is just according to the understanding of Vern Swanson. This is not doctrine for the LDS Church, but it is hopefully anything in that would be in opposition or contrary or against that. Hopefully, it might just not have been dealt with fully. As you move from there, you see how the dots are just like this? Okay? And then you go to the left, and there is a primordial organization where these particles of intelligence, they must be intelligent. Okay? Kind of organize themselves. Like cleaves to like. In other words, light cleaves to light, and darkness cleaves to darkness. And on a gradation, on a scale, one above another, to the top and the bottom. And then from that material, heavenly parents conceive of children who are born in the celestial world of God. There they come to the earth and spend much of their first premortal existence on this earth. And then there's a war in heaven. They come to this planet and have a mortality. When they die, they go to the spirit world, and they live there and exist and do stuff and grow. And they're not dead, right? The dead aren't dead, not in their opinion, anyway. So there are no ghosts, particularly, but there must be phantoms. And then they are resurrected to one of four places, three kingdoms and one non-kingdom. That's it. There's a lot of detail in here that you won't find anywhere else. A part that I'm a little proud of, but I'm humble in my pride. You see, just to the right of the yellow arc, okay, there, just to the right of that goes ABXBA. In the bottom, it says Gethsemane, Calvary, Burial, Resurrection, and Ascension into Heaven. A close examination of that is a really important contribution of the atonement and how it relates. No detail to give you. That is kind of an original little bit here. So it's coming out. I do have my wife to thank, Elaine. I've since remarried Judy. So when Judy and I announced that we were going to be married, she got a knock on the door. And it was Elaine's mom and dad, grandma and grandpa, brothers and sisters, about 9 of them, or 10 of them, knocking on Judy's door and said, we'd like to take you to lunch and tell you about the guy that you're going to marry. Oh, boy, kind of interesting. And she married me anyway. No, they were very nice. They were super. Greatest people in the world from Canada. That is not the end of the story, of course. I mean, story never ends. It kind of, with this little project, there is a bit of a period at the end of a sentence. There'll be more sentences and paragraphs and chapters and more books. It just made me feel very, very happy. I'm going to dedicate this to Elaine and Brett. That's it. Thank you very much for letting me speak to you. Now I'd like to ask you if you have any questions. Yes, please.
Thank you so much for your being here, for the courage you show. When your wife and your son appeared to you, she said, he is dead. He is dead. Which is so totally opposite.
No.
Totally opposite of anybody else's experience. Jeff Olson, I don't think he's here, but his child, he had the same experience of touching, holding, smelling, sensing,
yeah.
Weight, all of that was there, but his son was alive.
My son was alive as well. My wife's point was, he's dead. I had these crazy thinking that he wasn't dead.
But what would that message be? Because we know no denomination, not from coming anywhere, just being spiritually focused, we know that life is always.
Always.
This little it's coat that I'm wearing is just going, but we are all one, and we are forever. Totally not having anything to do with any denomination. But so it threw me for a loop also the fact that you said he was like...
But no, I said cold like clay. The truth is, he isn't dead on the other side. He's not dead. He's alive as ever. But for me, I needed to know that he was deceased because I really didn't believe it. Somehow about them being just one coffin, not seeing two coffins, it was less reality, like you say, and more messaging. It was the message that I needed.
Is your chart available without waiting for the book to be published?
Yes and no. I'm turning it in. I'm hoping probably next week to my publisher. They'll put it on a schedule and publish it right away in a few months.
You're talking about just the chart?
Yeah, just the chart. Because the book is going to be a few couple of years. But the chart will be available quite soon. My publisher said that he looked at it and little gibberish. Have you ever seen a magic circle? Anybody know what a magic circle is? Where you have three numbers and three numbers and three numbers and three numbers. And they all total the same 815, I think it is, in each direction. But when you look at the square... with the numbers in the squares, it looks like gibberish. That looks like anything. But then you start to noodle it through, and you go, oh, that's the same. Oh, look at this. Perfect order. This chart is wrong, is inaccurate, and has tons of flaws. If I knew where they were, I'd try to change them. I don't know. In fact, I call it current thoughts. on the father and son's plan of joy and happiness. I can't be stupidly all wrong. I can't be lucky enough that it's all right. It's the best that I have, an accumulation of 45 years of determined study. It'll be available in some months. Cedar Fort, Inc. in Springville. Well, they won't have it even on their thing yet because I'm just turning it in. Their designers will want to tickle it here and there. I have some things I'd like them to do. So when they get it published, 2, 3 months, 4 months, it'll be out long before the book.
Hi, thank you so much for sharing your story. Was there any other time that your son or wife have appeared to you or talked to you?
No, it was singular. I'm not given to visions. I've had two. The other one is quite different than this. Has nothing to do with their death. But no, this was the only time. But I got to tell you, it came within a few days of when I needed it. I can't even believe how depressed I was. So thank heaven it came.
My question is that when your wife and child came to you, and I know you said that she only said those three words, I'm wondering if she spoke with you telepathically or helped you to spring out of this depression?
Very good question, yeah. The answer is I think so, because when I woke up, you know, was it in the body or out of the body, as Paul says, I do not know. I don't know if it was a dream. You know the word appear, that something looks like it's there, appearance. But I can tell you, I got the absolute sense and feel that she was communicating that everything's okay. Everything's great. It's wonderful. We're doing fine, excited about what we're about. Go on and do well. Yes, I think there was. It would have been just that washed over me, like you say, telepathically. It wasn't in words, but it was in message.
I just want to make a comment on that. So it was more like a total thought and feeling and everything all in one, right?
Yes.
What is the name of your book?
Okay. The book would have been done by Cedar Fort as well. Probably be done in 3 volumes. I'm about 320 pages apiece, because I'm already to page 836. I want to get it out earlier, so I don't want to wait for the whole thing to be done. So I'm doing the front half a little bit more. The book will be titled Mormon Theology of the Atonement, God's Plan of Salvation. I don't deal with Mormon doctrine. That's way above my pay grade. I just deal with theology. Mormon theology, you know, the study of that. And so I just feel like these are ruminations and research that I've made. And has anybody seen my book on Dynasty of the Holy Grail? By the way, it's in its second edition. You know, so don't hesitate to buy that. But anyway, no. Let me tell you, if I make 1/20, because I visited every Holy Grail site, if I make 1/20 or 1/30 of the price that I had to spend to write it, you know, I'll be lucky. Don't make money from these books. Maybe Raymond Moody makes money from these books, but not Vern Swanson. Can I ask a question of the audience? About 1971 or 2, there was a very famous woman came to Salt Lake City, and she was an author. Very famous. She had written 4 or 5 books on. She was like the, we had Raymond Moody here and this lady here.
Was it Elizabeth Kubler-Ross?
Kubler-Ross. That was exactly right. Thank you. What was her first name again?
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And I got to meet her and talk to her in 1972 at East High School. And that was wonderful.
It seems like seeing your wife and your son, it kind of changed your grief.
Totally, 180.
Just what would you say to people that are going through grief, but they haven't had that experience of seeing their loved one? And I think that's part of the grief, is not being able to see them. And then when you see them and it's okay, it takes a lot of the grief away.
I have an answer, I think. There's a gentleman, I mentioned him earlier, the artist, Kimball Warren. He lost 2 children when he was younger, you know, when we were just babies, maybe the age of my son. And he did not receive any consoling message from the other side or any particular thing. And it was hard on him, and he made it. I have to tell you, if you think that there is a way to success, like success is never ending, failure is never final, somehow there's a plan. And that it's going to be all right. And it's like this lady here said, it's eternal. I really know inside me. And that is, the universe is alive. And the universe is intelligent. And much of the universe is good. Some really evil. And the universe is eternal. But there is something in the universe, and I always call it living intelligence. God is made of it. You're made of it. Unorganized particles are made of it. Organized particles are made of it. Light, energy, and matter, truth. And they generally conspire to make you a success, to help you. The majority of the universe is on your side. And if you know that, I have a quote from there's a guy named Neil Maxwell, and it goes like this. If you believe that life is basically good, it allows you to absorb a bad day or year. So if you go in with the attitude that basically things are good, if I keep plugging, they who seek to do so, and those who plug forward will succeed. It's a little bit of a hope. That's the larger message, which I received personally, but that would be the larger message. Everything's fine. Everything is unfolding the way it should. Now, every one of you are going to die. I would like to be hit by a meteorite. Nobody's ever done that before. Be walking outside, boom, taken out by me. That'd be good, right? Well, everyone would be dying. I was hoping that God would make an exception for me, just for me, but he didn't. He won't. So this world is a celestial, mortal world. Even that is wonderful. And it's glorious.
You mentioned, if I understood you right, that when you saw your wife, you got up and held her and kissed her, and you felt
it.
You felt her.
I felt her, and I felt her warmth. Smell, somebody said I should smell. I smelled her hair. It was wonderful. She was so alive.
That seems just different than what we usually think about with a spirit.
I've come to the conclusion it was a vision. It's like Paul says in the Bible, whether in the body or out of the body, I am not able to tell. So I've been asking myself this question. Did I stand up and walk over to her? And I said, well, theologically, I don't know if this belittles or denigrates my whole experience or not. It probably was a vision or dream.
Right.
To me, it doesn't matter because you've had living dreams.
Maybe you were out of your body then at that point in time.
I might have been. If I was out of my body, then she would have felt.
Right.
Okay. Or if I had dreamed. Right now, I'm kind of 60-40 on that. I mean, I can't explain it. These things are more easily recounted than explained.
The last question was pretty much my question, but what was she wearing? Was it skin on skin, or was it skin on material?
That's a very good question. She was wearing, and I don't know, clothes. Like you say, what are you wearing? I'd say, some clothes.
So was she wearing...
I'm such a fashion... You know what my fashion statement is? I'm trying not to embarrass myself too badly. That's my fashion statement. But I remember I touched her arm, skin on skin, and her shoulder, and I kissed her face with my lips. And just kissing, kiss, kiss. You're just so thrilled. You know, like you've met somebody that you haven't seen in a million years, but... Her dress was, I can't explain it, but she had a dress on. She used boy clothes. It was light. It was not dark clothing. I know that. And I just get the idea it was a robe. It didn't seem like it was contemporary or non-contemporary. I was nondescript. I don't know. But I know that it was light in color, had a color, as your blue.
But it wasn't clothing that you would have recognized. Oh, that's the dress she...
No, not at all. It would be the clothes that I would have thought typically. And Brett didn't have any clothes on. So he was naked.
And you perceived that you were touching a terrestrial body.
Well, it would be a physical experience, yes. I would say terrestrial, not telestial, yes.
Terrestrial, where we live.
I think that's absolutely right, yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, she could have been a resurrected already. She could have been a resurrected.
Well, that's entirely... So. I hadn't thought of that.
Possible.
Usually, the general resurrection hasn't happened yet, but people are being resurrected even now. Why she would be particularly chosen to be resurrected, I don't know. Could be, yes.
I've just heard other stories, and I've had experiences myself where I felt the spirit. So it doesn't have to be a dream, but it could have been.
Yeah, it could have been. Very, very good. I had not thought of the resurrection angle concept. Yeah, very, very wonderful. Thank you.
You mentioned when you saw your wife, she was kind of, I think you said she was maybe sitting, looking away from you.
Standing, yes. Like if this was the bed, my pillow's up there, and I'm feet down here, and she was here. Now, why wouldn't she be at least here, as opposed to here? I don't know. So I went like this. I remember that very clearly. Does anybody know what that might be about?
Well, I was going to say, was it like she knew that you knew she was there because she was waiting for you to come to her? And I almost wonder if your experience with her was usually one such like that, where maybe she's not facing you directly and she's waiting for you to come to her. And so that was the more natural way for you to come to her.
I don't think so. I have a very good relationship, loving. Now, she's really quite direct. She's a very strong woman, I got to tell you. And when I married Judy, I married my first wife over again. The Milne family have adopted my present wife, just spiritually and family-wise. I mean, they've adopted her. I wouldn't think that wouldn't have a connotation of that was the paradigm of our life, because she's very direct. I am too.
I really enjoyed the part that you said when you mentioned she's very businesslike, very serious.
Very serious. I mean, she had a message, and that was it. You know, I didn't need any more. I'm writing a thing called 500 Questions I Would Ask an Angel. Well, first of all, you got to be careful of the angel, right? Yeah, you got to get the right angel. It's got to be an angel sent from God. It's got to be an angel who is not a dim bulb. It's got to be a bright angel. Smart angel, you know, that has answers, right? Okay, you know, one person goes, I don't know. I don't know. Okay, and it's got to be a talkative angel. Because my wife wasn't talking much. She said my name, and that woke me up. The truth is I would not accept questions I ask an angel. I never have. I never pray to know if I have the right answer or not. I pray to be an honest researcher, that I'd be blessed in research and study, and that I just work hard. It's way above my pay grade to get any definitive answers from deity or angels.
Vern, I was just wondering, maybe that last question he asked, her sense away from you, do you think that was symbolic to communicate that expression that she was trying to tell you?
I don't know. First question I'm going to ask her, we will meet. I do remember when you came and you were really all kind of businesslike and officious. And I understand why you had to do that. This was not funny business. The deceased do not deal with the living very much. I'm going to ask her that question. Why were you up at that angle? Why weren't you just right there so I could just jump out of bed and not have to run around? It's interesting, but I haven't figured it out yet, so... But I will ask you. And when I do, I'll get back with you, Russell. Good. Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for coming.